From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. If you watched a cable news show in the days following the shooting in Aurora, Colorado, you'll get a sense of just how charged the atmosphere is over guns. In his book, Gunfight, the scholar Adam Winkler calls guns the lightning rod of American culture. One side sees guns as a critical part of personal freedom, a principle embedded in the Constitution. But the other side argues the Second Amendment wasn't written to protect individual rights and that guns are just instruments of mayhem and violence. Winkler says if you really look at the history of guns and gun laws in this country, you'll understand it doesn't have to be one side or the other. He says Americans have always had a right to keep a gun, but we've also always had gun control. Today in the program, Winkler will join us to talk about the battle over the right to bear arms in America. After the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. So if you watch a cable news program in the days following the shooting in Aurora, Colorado, you get a sense of just how charged the atmosphere is over guns. In his book, Gunfight, the scholar Adam Winkler calls guns the lightning rods of American culture. On one side, those see guns as a critical part of personal freedom, a principle embedded in the Constitution. The other side argues the Second Amendment wasn't written to protect individual rights. In fact, that guns are an instrument of mayhem and violence. But Winkler says if you really look at the history of guns and gun laws in this country, you'll understand it doesn't have to be one side or the other. His book is called Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America. And today in the program, Adam Winkler is joining us to talk about it. We invite you to join us as well if you have comments or questions. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Adam Winkler is a professor of constitutional law at the UCLA School of Law. His book is called Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America, as I said, and he's joining us from a studio at the campus of UCLA. Adam Winkler, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
So you say early in the book that when you first were talking to people about writing the book, they would always ask you the same question. Is it pro-gun or is it anti-gun? Why do you figure you got that response? What does that say to you?
Well, I think it's a reflection of the extremism of the gun debate in America, how divided we are on this issue, that we view guns as something you are either for totally or against totally. The argument I tried to make in my book is that that's not the way America has approached guns in the past, that we've actually balanced gun rights with public safety from our earliest days.
Talk about the state of the debate today, because you put it sort of in a broader context. You say it reflects the larger polarization of American politics, you know, abortion and health care, same-sex marriage, those kinds of things. And you say that, really, we should be able to bridge the gaps. You talk about that there's technology now, there's information. We should be able to craft reasonable laws. But I guess the problem is it's become overwhelmingly a political issue now.
Well, that's right. Over the past 30 years, extremists on both sides of the aisle have dominated the gun debate with simplistic slogans and unreasonable positions. I mean, gun rights hardliners view all gun control proposals as an infringement of the Second Amendment, while gun control zealots support any regulation of firearms, no matter how predictably ineffective, and often deny the existence of one of our oldest, most established constitutional rights. The two sides draw different conclusions, but they both begin with the same premise, that gun control and the right to bear arms cannot coexist, that we must choose one or the other. And I think that's wrong. And what I tried to show in Gunfight is that we've always had the right to bear arms, but we've also always had gun control. They've lived together side by side since the birth of America.
Why do you figure we as a country seem to love guns so much? How has it come to be bound up in our character, do you think?
Well, it may be tied to our status as a nation that was born on the frontier. You know, out on the Wild West in the old frontier, a land that was conquered by white settlers, guns were necessary. There was no law out there, and we needed guns. And we've had a culture that's glorified guns ever since. And I think you couple that with a general American distaste for government solutions to public problems and a distrust of government as the entity that would have a monopoly on all force, and you have a recipe for a strong gun culture.
I wonder what you were expecting in the way of the reaction to your book and what kind of reaction you're getting now, because you tell a really interesting story in the book about another person who wrote a book. Michael Belsiles wrote a book in, I think it was 2000, called Arming America. And in that, in the book, he argues that in the early years of this country, there, you know, there weren't really that many guns, or they weren't maintained very well. There wasn't really a gun culture. And it was pretty controversial, the book, as you write about it in yours, really well received, won the Bancroft Prize, got amazing reviews. But then this scholar named Jim Lindgren, anyway, started digging in and found some really serious errors. And it seems like there was a kind of a cautionary tale in the story. I wanted you to talk about that, if you would.
Well, I would say that I was a little bit worried about writing a book about guns in light of what happened to Michael Beliel. Michael Beliel was a history professor at the university, at Emory University, and wrote a book that was appeared to be very well researched about the history of guns. And what he showed was that America's founders could not have relied on guns as much as today's gun rights advocates believe, because guns were extremely rare. And the basis, the evidence that he used to make this argument was that he said he had gone through old probate records from early America in the early 18th century. Probate records are basically documents that inventory all of your possessions when you die. And what he found looking through these probate records was that very few probate inventories had guns, and those that did have guns often were listed as inoperable firearms. It turns out that when Jim Lindgren and others went and started to investigate his claims, they found out that there was an incredibly high rate of error in his study of these probate records, and all of the errors pointed in the same direction. Fewer guns, more support for Michael Beliel's thesis. Mm. When he was asked to provide the documentation that he had relied on, he said it had all been destroyed and he no longer had it. And so then he was asked, well, where did you collect the information? We'll go back and double check your work. And he said one of the places he got evidence was from the San Francisco probate records that were maintained in a courthouse in San Francisco. It turns out that those records had been destroyed in the Great Fire over 100 years ago. So either Michael Beliel's a very, very old guy, or he didn't really see those records.
So what do you make of that story? Because here's what you write in the book. You say, where did he go wrong? And you say, not when he took on gun lovers. You said that happens from time to time. Not when he made these surprising discoveries about certain facets in American life. That happens from time to time, too. You say where he really went wrong was, as you put it, by hoping that appearances are all that matter. What do you mean?
Well, and I think that, well, he wrote this book and it looked really, really exhaustive. It had, I don't recall the exact number of pages, but it was like 150 pages of footnotes. So it looked like a very, very well-researched book. But I think the reason I talk about Beliel is because I think of him in some ways as emblematic of gun control extremists who often push for gun laws that are symbolic in nature, but will not have any real effect on gun violence or enhance public safety at all. Take the Washington, D.C. law involved in the District of Columbia against Heller case, which is the subject of much of my book, which is a law that banned civilians from owning handguns. Well, this didn't actually stop any criminals from having handguns. And indeed, 10 years after that law was passed, Washington, D.C. was known as the murder capital of the United States. Too often in the gun control community, we see an effort to do something, anything, to respond to gun violence with laws that are predictably ineffective and really are just symbolic politics and don't really have any real-world effect.
Mm. I want to spend some time with the Heller case because, as you say, you sort of build the book around this case. This was the ruling that came from the case called District of Columbia versus Heller. And two particular lawyers that you profile, although there are a number of others. Walter Dellinger on one side, he's this well-regarded lawyer, former Solicitor General, and he's making the case that the Second Amendment did not protect an individual right to bear arms outside of a militia. In other words, it's not an individual right. That's a person you have on one side. The other person you have on the other side is a man by the name of Alan Gura, young guy, didn't really belong to one of the major firms, wasn't a scholar on the Constitution, never argued a case really before the High Court. But these were the two perspectives, and his argument is that, in fact, it was. The Second Amendment is an individual right. Talk about this case to sort of set this up for us and the two different kinds of perspectives, and then we can sort of dig deeper into it.
Well, the Supreme Court had mentioned the Second Amendment in passing through the years, but the justices had remarkably never squarely ruled on the meaning of this controversial provision. People had challenged gun laws in court, but they were usually criminals desperately seeking to overturn convictions for gun crimes. And let's face it, United States against crackhead was not exactly a promising vehicle for interpreting the Second Amendment. So over the past 30 years, however, pressure mounted from a social movement to protect gun rights, which formed in the wake of federal and state gun control laws adopted in the 1960s. And this inspired three entrepreneurial libertarian lawyers led by, as you said, Alan Gura, to bring the Heller lawsuit. And they mimicked the NAACP Legal Defense Fund's efforts in the civil rights movement. They strategically recruited ideal law-abiding plaintiffs and challenged the most restrictive gun law in the nation. And their case was welcomed by an increasingly conservative Supreme Court, even though, ironically, the NRA, the nation's leading gun rights organization, sought to quash their case at every turn.
Yeah. That's really interesting. Explain that. You say the NRA, I guess they were really worried about losing for obvious reasons, but you also said they were a little worried about winning. At least that's what Alan Gura has said, that a win would take away a pretty important fundraising strategy.
Well, that's what some people suspected in the libertarian community that was favoring the Heller lawsuit. What happened was is when the libertarian lawyers first announced they were going to bring this lawsuit, they had some connections with the gun rights movement, but none of them were big in the gun rights movement. None of them were affiliated with the NRA. And this law had been on the books since 1976, and the NRA was not challenging it. The NRA was perfectly content, apparently, to have this law on the books, although obviously they prefer it not to be there. But the NRA said they didn't want to take this case to the Supreme Court. They were afraid that the justices on the Supreme Court might reject their view of the Second Amendment. And what could be more devastating to the NRA than having this Supreme Court, with at the time 7 of 9 Republican appointees and a conservative reputation, reject their view of the Second Amendment? Mm-hmm. Gura thought, after his dealings with the NRA, that the only thing they were afraid of more than losing was winning. That the NRA thrives on a crisis-driven fundraising appeals, and this would interfere with those appeals because you can't tell gun owners the government's coming to take away all your guns if the Supreme Court says the government can never come take all your guns.
Mm. When did legal scholars first start paying attention to the meaning of the Second Amendment? Because you write about the fact that it was relatively it wasn't until fairly late in our story, our history.
That's right. It wasn't really until the late 1960s, early 1970s, and really didn't take off until after 1980, when we saw an incredible wave of scholarship. There had been a few articles written before that in legal journals that had argued about the Second Amendment, but by and large, they had all accepted the view that the Second Amendment was a militia-based right, a right to serve in state militias and to be free from federal interference with those state entities, and not an individual right to bear arms. But all that really changed as more people began to look closely at the history. One of the things that I argue in the book is that regardless of the controversy over the Second Amendment, which I believe is best interpreted as protecting an individual right to bear arms, but regardless of the Second Amendment, the right to bear arms is one of our oldest, most established rights, that almost every state protects the right to bear arms in state constitutional law, and that the 14th Amendment, adopted after the Civil War, was also designed in part to protect the right of freedmen to possess arms against marauding white racists like the KKK.
Mm. Race is an important part of the book, and we'll get to that as we go along. Were you surprised by that race was such a component in the battle over gun rights?
Well, it was one of the most interesting and disturbing things that I found in writing Gunfight, which was the relationship between race and racism and how that's influenced the story of guns in America. Some of America's earliest gun control laws were racially discriminatory. The founding fathers, who wrote the Second Amendment, also supported racially discriminatory laws that barred slaves and even free blacks from possessing guns. And the KKK began, in some sense, as a gun control organization. Before the Civil War, blacks in the South were never allowed to own guns. But during the Civil War, many blacks got their hands on guns. Either they served in black units of the Union Army, or they purchased guns that were manufactured for the war and that flooded the marketplace when the war was over. Racist whites formed posses like the KKK to go out at night and confiscate those guns so that blacks would be disarmed and they wouldn't be able to fight back against the reestablishment of white supremacy.
I wanted to go back and give some historical context, as you do in the book, for the Second Amendment and for the early ideas in this country related to guns. I mean, you write about the events of December 16th, 1689, a long time ago, and you say it was one of the most important dates in American history. Take us back there, if you would, and talk about how this relates to the way colonists of the time, who were going to go on to, of course, write the Constitution, were thinking about the idea of a gun.
Well, we always have to remember that our founding fathers weren't Americans. They were British. They were Brits who took seriously the tradition and history of their nation and forged their own, of course, to become Americans. But their legal traditions came from across the sea. And in 1689, why that date was so important was because that was the date that British monarch accepted the English Bill of Rights, a new document that established what exactly were the fundamental rights of English citizens. One of the English Bill of Rights is filled with several provisions that we would recognize: protection against unreasonable searches and seizures, protection for due process of law, a right to petition your government for redress of grievances, things that we see echoed in our own Bill of Rights. And they also had the English Bill of Rights also had a provision on guns and that was adopted in part because the James II, who was the last Catholic king of England, had really tried to go around the countryside and disarm all the Protestants. That helped shape the founders' forefathers' views of the importance of a right to be armed and not to have tyrannical government take away all your guns.
One of the measures was to confiscate the guns of colonists in 1774. This was on people's minds at the time as they were later come to draft a constitution, American constitution.
Well, that's right. If we then skip forward to the Revolutionary era, the founding fathers themselves were revolutionaries. And one of the things that the English king, no longer James II, who had been deposed back in the 1680s, but now George III, George III sought to put down the rebellious colonists. But like James II, he thought that the best solution was to disarm those who he feared were going to revolt. In this case, it was the most rebellious colonists, those in Massachusetts. King George tried to do everything he could to take away all of the guns that were possessed by people in Massachusetts so that they would not be able to revolt.
So it seems like – so remember when Sarah Palin got a lot of flack in the – a couple of years ago when she was – you know, before she decided not to run, and she was in Boston and she had mentioned the midnight ride of Paul Revere, and she had said that the essence of that was that Paul was trying to warn people that the British were coming for our guns. And she took a lot of flack for that, but it seems like what you're saying is she was right, that at least in the case of Paul Revere, that was one of the things he was absolutely worried about.
That's right. I believe that there were some of the factual details that Sarah Palin got wrong that day in that speech. However, the basic gist of it was right. I mean, when Paul Revere, as every school child in America learns, rode in the back alleys shouting, "The British are coming, the British are coming," The reason why the British were coming was to take away Americans' guns, in particular, a stockpile of guns that were held at an arsenal in the Lexington and Concord area. Of course, everything else we know about Paul Revere's ride is completely wrong. He didn't shout through the countryside. The countryside was filled with loyalists, people who were loyal to the king. So he went very quietly through the countryside rather than shouting, warning people that it was time for the militia to arm up to protect that stock of weapons that was in the Concord-Lexington area. And indeed, the very next day, the British did come. They did come to that arsenal. The American colonists decided to fight back. And that next morning was the famous shot heard round the world. It was the start of the American Revolution.
You talk about how the Founding Fathers had, in fact, supported gun control laws that were, as you write in the book, so extensive that few Americans would today support them. I wanted to go through some of those laws, if we could. I mean,
sure.
For example, you did talk about the fact that in the book that they didn't have restrictions on, for example, the commercial sale of firearms. There weren't any licensing of gun dealers. No, I guess, no mandatory background checks. Things like that. They didn't have laws, for example, this was interesting, they didn't have laws banning guns in schools or government places. And I was fascinated to read, as you put in the book, in some colonies, people were actually required to bring their guns to church.
That's right. There was a fear that people or colonies that might be attacked by Native Americans and the local tribes. And so part of the way in which you promoted public safety was having more armed citizens. But the Founding Fathers strongly believed in the right to bear arms and that individuals should have that right. Yet they also had gun control laws. They barred large portions of the population from possessing guns. And as I mentioned, slaves and free blacks, but even white men who opposed the revolution. I'm not talking about traitors here, but law-abiding citizens who were exercising their freedom of speech to argue that these 13 disunited colonies taking on the most powerful nation in the world was a mistake at the time. And they also had severe militia laws, the founders, which required gun owners to appear at public gatherings with where they and their guns would be inspected and, yes, even registered on state rolls. As I point out in the book, they even had a version of the individual mandate. You know, that's the controversial provision in President Obama's health care law, Obamacare, that requires individuals to go out and buy insurance. The Founding Fathers required citizens to arm themselves with military-style firearms so that they could be ready to fight in an instant.
So, I mean, you have those two sides. You know, one side that says it's an absolute right, the Second Amendment, all right, as you put it in the book, no regulation. And then there's the other side, all regulation and no right. And I guess what you're saying, it's the essence of the book, is that the answer somewhere in the middle. Rights were very important, but also it didn't seem egregious to create laws that made some control on firearms.
That's right. The Founding Fathers balanced their view that individuals should have the right to bear arms and the idea that government should not be able to take away all of the guns out of civilians' hands with the idea of public safety. I should point out that I don't believe that we should have the same kinds of gun control laws that the Founding Fathers had. We shouldn't be barring people from possessing guns on the basis of their race or their political ideology. The broader point really is that the Founding Fathers recognized that where they thought it was necessary for public safety to regulate guns, the Second Amendment did not stand in the way. So I think that just as they drew a balance, gun rights and public safety, to reflect their sense of what was necessary for the public welfare, we need to be able to do the same thing today.
Adam Winkler is with us. He's a law professor, author of the book Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America. You can join us, 801-585-WEST is our number, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with the scholar Adam Winkler. We're talking about his book, Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America. We invite you to join us. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. One of the things you work through in the book is the interesting history of the National Rifle Association. Let's talk about where the NRA really came from. Founded in 1871, but it wasn't the group we understand today, a gun lobbyist group. It was really something else entirely, it seems.
That's right. I mean, today the NRA is widely seen to be a diehard, no-compromises opponent of gun control. But the NRA was originally founded after the Civil War with the Second Amendment far from its mind. It was formed, ironically, by a reporter for a newspaper not known today for its support of gun rights, the New York Times.
Right.
And the idea was to promote marksmanship training because the two men who formed it had served in the Union Army and thought that the Civil War had gone on as long as it did because the Southern men were so much better equipped to fire firearms. They had so much better training with firearms, and the Northern men did not. And so they thought it was essential for American military success to train people better on how to use military-style firearms. In the 1920s and the 1930s, the NRA was at the forefront of the gun control movement, drafting restrictive gun control laws and then promoting them in state after state. In fact, when Congress was considering the first major federal gun control law, the president of the NRA was asked whether it violated the Second Amendment. And from the perspective of today, his reply is pretty astounding. He said, quote, "I have not given it any study from that point of view." Indeed, before the 1960s, the NRA's publications rarely mentioned the Second Amendment at all. As I explain in Gunfight, it wasn't until the NRA was transformed in the 1970s that the Second Amendment became the organization's heart and soul.
Let's talk about the way it evolved, because you mentioned how in the 60s, so you're starting to see the NRA membership changing. You talk about there were rising crime rates now, and so guns started to become less about, you know, hunting and marksmanship. And now it started to be this thing that they were thinking about guns as self-protection, which seems an important evolution in the country itself. This idea that, as you say, this isn't really now in the 21st century a rural issue. It's not about hunting. This is really about self-protection. That's an important point you make in the book.
I think one of the great misunderstandings of the gun rights movement today is that people, especially people in the media, tend to think that people support gun rights merely as part of a rural culture, that someone who grew up out in outside of the cities, who was raised on hunting and who went for his 10th birthday on a hunting trip with his dad and got his first rifle for that trip, you know, they think that's kind of a cultural attachment to guns. And while certainly there is that element in the gun rights movement, the strongest element really, it comes from people who want to bear arms to protect themselves in urban areas, to protect themselves against criminals anyone who might do danger to them. If you think it's hard to get the gun away from someone who got that gun on his 10th birthday from his dad, it's even much harder to take the gun away from someone who has to keep a pistol near his bed at night because he thinks he won't survive the night without it. If you think your life is on the line, you're not giving up that gun.
So it's interesting. It seems like there's this rift that starts to grow within the NRA in the late 60s and 70s. And leadership is not adapting to this idea that guns are about self-protection and about rights. I mean, they still want them to be about safety and marksmanship training, those kinds of things. And in fact, you even mentioned that many of leaders of the organization wanted to back away entirely from politics and lobbying. But then there appears on the scene this man named Harlan Carter. He's a man with an interesting reputation. He had a good shot and had a bit of an infamous past. But he starts to really get people's attention within the NRA. Talk about Harlan Carter, if you would.
Well, the NRA really changes overnight. In 1968, the NRA endorses, with some reservations, but they endorse the Gun Control Act of 1968, which is the first major federal gun control law in over 30 years. And the moderate leadership of the NRA decides that they want to retreat from political lobbying. They want to move the NRA's headquarters out of Washington, D.C. and move it to Colorado Springs, where they're going to refocus on hunting activities and outdoor activities. And this enrages a group of hardliners in the NRA, led by Harlan Carter, people who believe that guns aren't for duck hunting, but for self-protection against these in a time of rising crime rates. And literally overnight, at an annual membership meeting of the NRA in 1977, Harlan Carter and some allies in the hardliner gun rights movement organize strategically a coup. And manipulating the rules of order for the meeting, they successfully replaced the entire leadership of the NRA overnight. And when the sun rises, Harlan Carter's the new head of the NRA. The entire board's been replaced. And the new mission of the NRA is to refocus on fighting gun control and protection of the Second Amendment.
Mm. They adopt a new motto in the process as well. And this is I guess this is one of the first times we start to see this focus on the Second Amendment as part of the NRA.
That's right. I went through decades of the NRA's signature publication, American Rifleman. Any listeners who are members of the NRA received this as part of their membership. And in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, you can go through decades of these issues and not find a single mention of the Second Amendment. If you open up the magazine today, you're guaranteed to find the Second Amendment mentioned on just about every other page, a real sign of how much the NRA has changed over the years. And in fact, the NRA is in court today fighting to overturn the restrictive gun control laws that the NRA itself drafted and promoted in state after state in the 1920s and 1930s.
The current CEO and executive vice president of the NRA is Wayne LaPierre. You mentioned in the book that he's Harlan Carter's really most important successor. Talk about LaPierre and really where he's taking the organization now, and maybe explain how it is that the NRA has become so powerful politically.
Well, you have to hand it to Wayne LaPierre. I'm critical of the book, of some of Wayne LaPierre's outrageous statements, and sometimes I think his extremist positions on guns that do not advance public safety as much as one might hope. But you have to hand it to him. He has overseen the NRA while the NRA has become the most powerful political organization in America, such that we have this Aurora shooting last week, and the prospects for gun control are non-existent. There's no chance that gun control is going to pass. And that's a testament to the strength of the NRA. I mean, it should also be noted that the NRA's success comes in part due to the weakness of the gun control movement. Mm. Mayor Michael Bloomberg said last week that the gun control movement needs leadership. It doesn't need leadership. It has leaders, including Michael Bloomberg. What it needs is followers. And the truth is gun rights advocates will vote on the basis of a candidate's position on guns, even if it's not a real issue in the campaign, even if there's no gun control laws going to come up in the next legislative session. Mm. They'll vote on that basis. They'll contribute to the organizations like the NRA and the candidates who oppose gun control. And gun control supporters, although they poll favoritism for preference for gun control, polls pretty high, gun control supporters are not intense believers in that, and they don't vote on that basis, and they don't contribute on that basis. And in a democracy, if you don't give and you don't vote, you don't win.
Mm. Do you think that part of the problem might be that those who are the leaders of gun control movements are, as you put it in the book, prone to their own brand of extremism? You know, this idea that the ultimate goal is to eliminate privately owned firearms, which you say is completely unrealistic and shouldn't really be the focus of all of this. Do you think they're too extreme? They're not thinking about it in more moderate ways, I guess.
Well, I do think that they don't think of it in as level-headed a way as they should. I don't believe that the majority of the leaders of the gun right of the gun control movement today realistically think they can disarm America. There's 280 million guns in America, almost one per person, more than one per adult, and they're not going anywhere. And I think anyone with who looks at it seriously recognizes that it's not going to go anywhere. But in the absence of disarmament being a true a realistic possibility, many in the gun control community support ineffective and ineffective laws that either reflect lack of understanding of guns or will be interpreted by gun owners as merely a hassle to them. I'll give you an example, because some people in the gun control community say I'm much too harsh on them, that all they really want are reasonable laws.
Yeah.
Well, Chicago used to ban handguns, and the Supreme Court in 2010 basically overturned Chicago's ban on handguns. And so Chicago responded by saying, okay, we'll follow the Supreme Court's ruling. We'll allow people to have handguns, but if you want to have a handgun in your home, you have to do an hour of training on a gun range first. And then they passed a law barring the operation of any gun range in the city of Chicago. You know, that's the kind of law that is, if it happened in any of the areas that people on the left prefer, they would argue is absolutely insane. We wouldn't want someone to say, well, you can exercise your right to choose abortion, but there is no will outlaw the operation of any abortion clinic in the state. It would be absurd. And so it's an example of what I think of are the symbolic and silly laws that are destined to be struck down by the courts in light of the Heller case.
You know, what's interesting about the Aurora shooting is that, of course, you're starting to hear calls for gun control in light of it, you know, assault weapons bans, those kinds of things. You know, and you're also hearing about people trying to sort of limit the political power of organizations like the NRA. But what you've written is that you really aren't expecting much to change in light of the Aurora shootings. And you talk about how over the past 20 years or so, tragic mass shootings just haven't really led to much change in gun law.
That's right. And that used to not be the case.
Yeah.
It used to be the case that mass shootings did and high profile shootings did lead to gun control laws. In fact, the federal law I mentioned earlier, the law passed in 1934 that the NRA's president was asked to testify about, that was largely in response to the St. Valentine's Day massacre and the increasing high profile use of machine guns, the Tommy gun in particular, by the gangsters in Chicago like Al Capone and desperados like Bonnie and Clyde. But today things are really different. We've had a number of mass shootings from Fort Hood and Seal Beach and Binghamton, New York, Columbine, that haven't really sparked any new gun control laws. And part of that is because it's difficult to figure out what kind of law would stop a madman like James Holmes from committing the crimes that he committed.
Yeah.
But also part of it is because the gun control movement is very weak and they set their sights on the wrong things. You've heard these days, you're hearing talk about, well, why should anyone ever be allowed to buy 6,000 rounds of ammunition? And if you put it in those terms, it seems like an awful lot. But anyone who knows anything about firearms and who goes shooting knows that, you know, if you go to the gun range at night with a couple friends, you're going to shoot 500 rounds of ammunition in a night. And so to have 6,000 rounds of ammunition over 60 days, if you're a gun enthusiast, that's not a huge number. So it might be an expensive number, but it's not a huge number.
But you've said what is not needed is a bunch of different laws in different states. What you say is that the only gun control laws really that would work would be federal, that they have to bind everyone together. They all should be the same in order for them to be effective. Am I getting that right?
I think that's absolutely right, because right now we have 51, maybe it's 52 patchwork of different state laws. We have a federal set of federal laws, and then we have 50 states, and then we have the District of Columbia with its own laws as well. So we have all these different states and different regimes, and they can't really be effective because the law that D.C. passed to ban handguns wasn't effective because people could just go into Maryland and find a gun and bring it back into D.C. And so California, the state I live in, has very restrictive restrictive gun control laws, but they're rendered less effective by the fact that someone can pretty easily go into Arizona or in Nevada and purchase firearms. Now, those firearm sales may or may not be illegal depending on the particular circumstances, but it just shows how difficult it is with the patchwork of laws to be effective. And I also think that even with federal laws, we need federal gun control laws if we need any. The problem is even there, we must recognize that any gun control law is going to be rendered less effective by the fact that there are already 280 million guns in circulation in America. You could ban assault weapons, for instance, but there's already, I don't know what the exact number is, but there's probably 20 to 30 million AR-15s out there. What are you going to do about all those guns that are currently out there? No one's going to turn them in. Gun owners don't believe in turning in their guns, and so they're not going to. So you've got a law that now has a huge gaping loophole because it has 15 million guns that are not supposed to be out there that will be. So we have to be realistic about what we can do with gun control. It doesn't mean we should never have it. We should just be realistic about what it will accomplish.
Let's take a few calls. 801-585-WEST is the number to join the conversation. Mark is with us in Salt Lake City. Mark, welcome.
Thank you. What disturbs me about all of this is that the NRA has already guaranteed, as you've just said, that there's so many guns out there that any gun control is moot. So they go on about the unrestricted right to own guns based on the Second Amendment. There's a word in there that says regulated, well regulated. I have no problem with somebody owning a gun, but it should be regulated. They should be permitted. They should have to pass a test. They should have records of it. And it seems to be that that is the fairest compromise in order to, you know, control access to, you know, restrict it from, you know, crazy people and unstable people. And if we take, the other thing is that I think we should call their bluff. They always go on about how there should be no restrictions on what you buy and how you buy it and when you buy it. Okay, let's call their bluff and say, okay, now we are allowing guns on planes, in Congress, in courthouses, everywhere, at all times, on cars, and why stop at guns? Let's bazookas, tanks, all weapons. It doesn't say that there's a restriction on what kind of weapon you have. So how far, you know, why don't we just take it, call their bluff, and see where they draw the line?
Well, let me ask you, Adam Winkler, to his initial point, the idea about the word regulated, does that seem like a compromise that could work in the current political atmosphere?
Well, I don't think in the current political atmosphere we're going to have any compromise whatsoever. So I'm not sanguine about that.
Yeah.
I think there are specific reforms that we could adopt. I think we should have background checks on every single gun sale. Currently, under federal law, only about 60% of lawful gun sales go through a background check. And there's no reason for that. I think even the NRA agrees that felons shouldn't get their hands on guns, that people who are mentally ill shouldn't be able to get their hands on guns. We should be doing everything we can to make sure that if you sell your gun to someone who you meet on the street or in your gun club, that they're not a felon and they're not mentally ill, that they're not a prohibited purchaser. But I do think that the most important thing we need to do for the gun debate, and why I'm hopeful in the long run that compromise is possible, is that I think we need to change the dynamics of the debate. And I think that the Supreme Court's decision in the Heller case may help us do that in the long run, not in the short run. It hasn't happened yet, and it's not going to happen probably for 10 or 15 years. But to the extent that case gets more, becomes a more accepted part of our constitutional fabric, I think there's a lot of gun owners who disagree with the extremist positions of the NRA and will take an approach that says, hey, you know what? I'm not afraid that this gun law is going to lead us down the slippery slope towards total disarmament as I used to be because the Supreme Court has protected my right. And if we can get to that point, I think that the possibility of things like background checks for every gun purchase might be the kinds of compromise that we could find and achieve.
Let's take another call before we head to a break. Rita is with us in Mancos, Colorado. Rita, welcome.
Hi. First, I'd like to say that I'm really impressed with the quality of your the information and the delivery that your speaker has shown, and that you're getting great callers calling in too. I know that lots of people share my opinions. I'm a former NRA member. I'm a person who's hunted big game, waterfowl, a target shoot, a shotgun for quite a long time, and I still have kind of an emotional attachment to the last shotgun that I finally sold. Because after a shoulder injury, I knew I couldn't shoot it anymore. But I don't belong to the NRA anymore because they have taken, they seem to shift to having a large, their primary strategy seems to be more about protecting and supporting guns and weapons industry with a primary tactic of being emotionally dramatic, and they don't really care about the individual rights. They don't, they definitely don't represent my usage, my ownership, or my social values. And they seem to be wielding their power relentlessly to reform the Republican Party. I think the NRA and their course of action is part of why our Republican Party has also become has become so dramatic and emotion-based in the arguments they make. They don't go for a reason, and they can make misstatements because they're driving people to act for emotional satisfaction or emotional rewards.
Yeah. Let me get Adam Winkler to respond to that. Do you get a sense, are you hearing more of that, people who once were part of the organization or may be still part of the organization who are worried about the tactics? Is there any sense that some of the tactics are backfiring in any way?
Well, I don't know if they're backfiring because they're still so politically successful.
Yeah.
However, I do. When I was going around the country talking about gunfight, I meet so many gun owners who come to me and say, "You're absolutely right. The NRA has gone off the rails." That I've always supported the NRA because they were the ones supporting my right to bear arms. But there's no doubt that we could use some new leadership in the gun rights movement too. Leaders who recognize that there is a place for reasonable gun control. And it is a very emotional issue, but I do think that we can restore reason to the gun debate. I talk about in Gunfight one of the most famous photographs in American history. It was taken in 1957 when nine black teenagers arrived to integrate Central High School in Little Rock, Arkansas. And the photo shows a black girl in a white dress clutching her school book, and she's surrounded by this hostile, angry mob of white racists. And what's so memorable about the picture is that you can feel the white people's rage and hatred. It's so clear. But if you and I were standing on the street the corner that morning and I said, "Hey, I think we can move beyond the extreme polarization of the race debate in America," you'd have told me I was crazy. Yeah. Yet look how far we've come. It's not to say race isn't still an issue and sometimes a hot button one, but we've made incredible strides in how we talk and think about race. I think we can do the same for guns, and I'm hopeful that just as the Supreme Court opinions did this for race, maybe they can help us do this for guns as well.
Adam Winkler is with us. He's a professor of constitutional law at UCLA. His book is Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America. And we need to take another break. Rita, thanks very much for the call. 801-585-WEST, the number, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Adam Winkler. We're talking about his book, Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America. So I wanted to come back to the Heller case that you write about, and you explain that, you know, for the first time really in American history, now the Supreme Court has declared a gun control law had violated the Second Amendment to the Constitution. But what's really interesting about it, as you explain, is that the way the court ruled, it brushed aside a lot of those arguments, and it really declined, as you put it, to commit to any set determinate standard for courts to apply to future cases that would challenge gun control, which is really interesting. And I wanted to play a clip from Justice Antonin Scalia. He was on Fox News, I think it was last week, talking with Chris Wallace, and he talked about gun laws. And I wanted to play this and have you talk about it a little bit.
What the opinion in Heller said is that it will have to be decided in future cases what limitations upon the right to keep and bear arms are permissible. Some undoubtedly are, because there were some that were acknowledged at the time. For example, there was a tort called affrighting, which if you carried around a really horrible weapon just to scare people, like a head axe or something, that was... I believe, a misdemeanor. So, yes, there are some limitations that can be imposed. What they are will depend on what the society understood were reasonable limitations at the time. There were certain location limitations.
And he goes on to talk a little bit more. But it's interesting, what he's saying there is it's not an absolute right, that that there is some flexibility here in this ruling.
Well, that's right. The Heller case was an important victory for gun rights advocates because, despite the NRA's opposition to the case originally, Alan Gura and his team of libertarian lawyers were successful in the Supreme Court, and the court did declare individuals to have a right to bear arms protected by the Second Amendment. But the court went out of its way, in an opinion written by Justice Scalia, to say that there are still reasonable regulations that can be imposed on gun owners. One of the things that's so remarkable, though, that's very different from what Justice Scalia said. Justice Scalia said in that Fox interview that we're going to have to look to what kinds of laws were in place during the founding era.
Yeah.
One, I think that's a big mistake because they had a very different kind of society, a very different kind of technology with regards to guns. I don't think we can find particularly helpful answers by looking at the founding fathers. And frankly, I don't think Scalia believes that either. In the Heller opinion, Scalia wrote that nothing in the opinion should be taken to cast doubt on longstanding prohibitions on the possession of firearms by felons or the mentally ill, restrictions on guns in sensitive places like schools or government buildings, or restrictions on the commercial sale of firearms, something like presumably background checks. But none of those laws had any basis in the founding era. Those are laws that come from regulation of guns in the 20th century. Mm. And so while Heller was hailed at the time as a triumph of originalism, when the scope of a right is defined not by the laws of the 1790s, but by the laws of the 20th century, that's not originalism. It's living constitutionalism. Yeah. And that's really what Heller represents, I think.
Which is such a profound irony when you think about the way Scalia measures the idea of originalism. You describe the ruling ultimately as kind of a catch-22. And in some ways, both sides have won.
I think both sides have won. While gun rights advocates hailed the case as a great victory that would lead to the end of gun control in America, I don't think that's likely to be the case at all. We have recognized the right to bear arms under state constitutional law since as early as the 1820s, and courts have consistently upheld gun regulation where it stops short of barring all people from possessing firearms. And I think Heller made that clear. And indeed, since Heller, there have been almost 400 federal court decisions on the constitutionality of gun control laws in the wake of that case, and all but a very, very tiny handful of laws have been upheld. So I think that Heller really reflects what we've always had in America, which is not the radical right to bear arms promoted by the NRA or the radical absence of a right to bear arms promoted by gun control organizations, but instead Heller captures what we've had as a reasonable right to bear arms, one where every individual does have a right to have a gun for personal protection, but at the same time, there is a legitimate place for good and effective gun control laws.
Adam Winkler, professor of constitutional law at UCLA. His book is called Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America. He joined us from a studio on the campus of UCLA. Adam Winkler, thank you very much for the time.
A pleasure to be here.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. We're getting a number of phone calls and some emails. We invite you to go to our discussion board on our website. You can continue the conversation. A lot of people are telling their particular stories about guns, so we invite you to join us there. We have technical direction from Mike Anderson. Our thanks to Susan Anderson, Matthew Martin, Tim Slover, our interns. The program produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.